This narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are casually critical.
Hello and welcome to Casually Critical, the podcast show starring two pals who love to talk about storytelling. I'm your host, Daniel Carpenter.
And I'm James Newton, your co-host. If you must blink, do it now. But I must warn you, if you fidget, if you listen to the spoiler section without watching Kubo and the Two Strings, your two co-hosts are certain to perish.
Internally, from the cringe of you accessing the forbidden spoilers ahead of time.
Although it is redundant to tell you not to blink because we'll never know if you do, and this is also an audio medium.
Right.
So we're just going to hold you accountable, honor system. Yeah, that kind of took away from the gravitas, but, you know. Kubo and the Two Strings.
Yeah.
What a movie.
What a movie. And for those of you who don't know, this is a movie that I think, at least for James and I, holds a very special place in our heart because this is the first ever movie we saw together.
Yeah. Brings a little tear to my eye.
We hardly knew each other. We were in the same group of people. James was part of the leadership on my dorm floor. They had an event where they're like, hey, let's see this stop motion movie. And I thought to myself, huh, okay. It looks interesting. And so some people were more excited about it than I was. I just thought, well, it'll be an interesting time. I've learned that whenever people get hyped for a movie, it usually ends in disappointment on my part. But to my utter shock, I had such a great time watching this movie. And I enjoyed it in theaters. And every time I've rewatched it since, there's always something new I take away in my appreciation of it.
Yes. And to drive that point a little bit further home, this is a movie similar to the way we felt about Knives Out. This is a movie I want to watch immediately after a second time. After the first viewing, I'm like, ooh, there's something that happened that recontextualizes everything, and I really want to watch this again now and see how that's kind of quietly playing out. And I won't spoil that right here and now, but it's really delightful, and I'm just going to say it right here, right now. Kubo and the Two Strings might be my favorite rom-com.
Really?
Yeah.
I can see that.
It's a fantasy adventure movie, but there's some rom-com elements that are really fun. And it's all branded and flavored in a way that is digestible to me. You know, it's not like an Adam Sandler rom-com where they live on a beach and it's California and there's a misunderstanding and it's very stereotypical. No, yeah. It's garmented with this beautiful fantasy world that I want to be in 24/7.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whimsicalness to some parts of this world. The visuals are absolutely through the roof. And that's saying a lot considering this is a stop motion film. And there are some moments in the stop motion, James, that I just went, it's like, oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
How did they do that? There's a scene early on involving Kubo and his mother, and they're staring out at the sunrise, and she's barely moving. But she's still moving, because if you observe human beings, you'll know that even when we try and stay still, we can't for very long, because we move naturally. There's breath that we take, there's slight shifting around of the body. And so when you animate that, I would argue that's the hardest thing to animate. If I animate a guy punching another guy in the face, that's pretty easy because it's a dynamic movement. But when you're animating someone who's supposed to be very, very still, and that way of animation is a stop motion animation,
yeah,
you need to really figure out how do they subtly move without it looking like you're just grabbing them and moving their, you know, doll figure around. Like there's a masterful, masterful attention to detail here. And Laika, the animation studio behind this movie, they really go all in on they put their money where their mouth is, specifically the mouths and the faces of the characters.
Yes.
There are several scenes that are carried solely by the expressions of the characters and not the voice acting. And that's a lot of faith in your own work to say, nope, we're so good at animating faces now to where we can just carry entire things with facial expressions.
Yes, for sure. And that would be even including the first scene, which is one of my favorite scenes of any movie.
The opening image is incredibly powerful.
Yes. No audio or no dialogue, just narration in that first bit. But then to follow where the main character is taking care of his mother, completely wordless, we get so many glimpses into what Kubo's life is like on the daily. And it's really fascinating. And to go off your point about faces, Daniel, I believe this might be the first film that Leica invested in 3D printing for, where the facial expressions were 3D modeled and then printed and then placed onto a panel on the rig of the stop motion puppet skeleton. But you could never tell it. It's very organic looking. There's a lot of asymmetrical facial expressions that happen that are really interesting. And it doesn't look like a robot chicken thing where they're just doing face replacement. They really make the faces look organic, even though this is a new field of stop motion animation in which everything is 3D printed. It still feels very organic, and you can feel the fingerprints, even though you can't see them. You can feel the fingerprints on these stop motion characters and on the fabric and on the intricate sets they're in.
Yeah, and the story, which, you know, you and I, it's one of the biggest sticking points for us with our movies. The story does something so difficult, and that is it breaks new ground where appropriate, and everywhere else it just does classics, but really, really, really well. The fantasy setting, the world building, the characters, it's all something I've seen before. But the way they texture it with a heavy influence on Japanese culture and the character designs and the physicality of how each character talks and moves and the combat and the action sequences.
Yes.
It's so well done. Everything has a little bit of extra oomph to it. It's like, yeah, I've seen this before. Hero's journey. I know this hero well. But even his abilities are different. He's not your sword swinging hero. There is a sword he needs to find, but it's not even really wielded by him for most of the movie.
Yep.
There are these other characters that are helping him out, and he has a personal investment in. Or as an audience in the beginning, we have an investment in because they're really great characters.
Mm-hmm.
They do animal sidekicks in a way that no other movie I've known has ever done before or since. And the humor? I think sometimes the humor doesn't need to be there, especially there's some scenes with Monkey in the very beginning that I felt was a little bit much. But once another character shows up, the humor really feels balanced out, and they rarely miss their stride after that. So for the most part, this is a very pitch-perfect movie. It hits all the right notes, and it hits them in different ways than movies before it have done.
And it makes me want another movie. I haven't ever really thought that until this time I watched Kubo. But I was like, can we get a Kubo 2? Like, what's the deal with these giant skulls we keep seeing around? What's the deal with these giant statues we keep seeing around? It's just like subtle world-building things that people probably didn't put much writing into, but just placed there to make people feel like the world was bigger. And that's how you do a small scale fantasy story and still make it feel grand. Because ultimately at the end of the day, it's between just a few characters. And there's really only one small thing at stake, but it's an important thing to this character. And it still feels big. There's travel. There's subtle world building, like I said. There's just big skulls and statues and things just lying around, just waiting to be explored. And that's a kind of excitement that stirs in me that really only good fantasy can do for me.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the star-studded cast we have here for Kubo?
Yeah. It is amazing how many people that you recognize are in this movie. You have Charlize Theron, who of Mad Max fame and Atomic Blonde and all these other movies. Then you have Matthew McConaughey. And I was shocked to hear he was in this movie, but as it turns out, he's actually done voice acting quite a bit. And his classic, all right, all right, all right, is missing. It's a very reduced, typical Matthew McConaughey. He embraces subtlety and restraint in his voice. Yeah. And the way he delivers on humor is very tasteful and very natural. And it's shocking how quickly he blends into his character. And that's partially kudos to Matthew McConaughey for delivering those lines, and kudos to the animators for really playing into where Matthew McConaughey was trying to lead with those lines and leading his character to express it in a natural way.
Yeah. We also get some short cameos from Ralph Fiennes and George Takei. George Takei only having two lines, but one of them being, "Oh my." And that's my best George Takei impersonation. So sorry, Star Trek fans. But yeah. Yes, he does get to say that, and it's fun.
Yes. Ralph Fiennes is one of the best. He has such a great voice. And his character, we're going to touch on a lot more in our spoiler review, so I'm not going to say really anything here, but he was a great choice for the role, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he brings a lot to it. We've touched on representation before, James. For me, I love this cast and I love the actors, but I think for me, it is weird having a movie that is predominantly set in Japan that is all about this Japanese influence, and pretty much every single major character is played by someone who isn't Japanese. There are Asian actors in this movie, but they're all supporting side characters. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a really great question, and it's actually something I was thinking about looking at the IMDb page the other day. There are two sort of camps that you can approach this from, and I'm not telling you this, Daniel, I'm telling the audience. One okay. being, the character needs to look like the actor. I mean, the actor needs to look like the character and needs to sound like the character. Other people say it's all about merit. If you can capture the character well with your voice and with your personality and with your acting, then it doesn't matter in animation because you don't see the actor in the first place. And so it's still representation because the character is this race under discussion. The person that's voicing them is not. And the people that animate them might not necessarily be either. And that's sort of a different question that is kind of intriguing to me. The people that animate and direct the movement of these fictional Japanese characters, do they need to be Japanese to understand the movement and the mannerisms of Japanese culture, even if they're Japanese Americans? Because Leica is a Portland studio. I'm not sure. But I am conflicted about this, and I do think Black Panther broke some good ground in the realm of just fully representing your characters and representing them well, and having the people behind the camera represent that well. Though I still shake my fist quietly at Black Panther because it was still executive produced by a white man. So it kind of feels fake. But I don't know. What do you think, Daniel?
I agree with everything you say. I think it's a very nuanced approach that a lot of people don't treat as nuanced. I think they treat it as very black and white, no pun intended, where it's like, listen, if you're this camp, then it's clearly obvious. Like, there should be no dissenting opinions.
Yeah.
For me, with Kubo, it's tricky because I seem to lean right now more in the camp of, if the actor is a good fit, why not cast them? As long as the icon, the image of the character they're playing is, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily have to reflect the actor behind the voice. Darth Vader, canonically in Star Wars, is a white man, but whenever he's Darth Vader, not Anakin Skywalker, he's voiced by a black man, James Earl Jones, because James Earl Jones has a freaking awesome voice.
Yeah.
However, most of the time in Hollywood, at least from my understanding, whenever someone of another race is voicing someone who's a minority or someone who isn't as often a figure in TV or film, it's usually a white person voicing a minority and not the other way around.
Yeah.
And I'm a little conflicted by that. I don't know. Here in California, at least, I know that there's racism problems that go both ways. There's someone I know who was applying for a job, and they were up against, it was them and a black person. And this black person was less qualified, but they were hired because of their race and solely because of their race. This person who was more qualified did not get that position. And it wasn't because they were less qualified. They weren't. They were more qualified. It was because of racism. And I know stories of the exact opposite. I know that it's not exactly a one-way street. So while it's something that I wrestle with and will continue to wrestle with, I don't necessarily think it's an inherent flaw or something to count against Kubo and the Two Strings. I think they were very, I think everyone in the voice cast knew what they were doing and really brought a lot of life and dimension to the characters as well.
I want to make a distinction about the story that you were telling about your friend, which it really is a shame. I think there's a distinction between racism and tokenism. I think the desire from that company and a lot of companies right now is to have a token black person or a token Hispanic person or a token Asian person in their workplace. And as a result, they scramble to hire somebody that may not be ready for the job or may not even like perform well at the job. But I wanted to say also, whenever a person that's white voices a minority character in animation, it does feel like the creators and the voice casters are kind of taking something away from that community that the animated character represents. Because yes, we do get representation in terms of the imagery, but we don't get representation in real life. Like someone of minority is not given an opportunity as a result of this product being made. And that is something else to consider. Obviously, I'm a young white man who doesn't know anything, so I don't feel how qualified. I don't know how qualified I would be to talk about this any further. But I do appreciate you posing the question, Daniel. It's something we haven't covered much.
No. But yeah, overall, kind of switching gears quite a bit.
Yes.
This is a film that is rare. It's rare to find a work of art this original, this well-crafted, and this successful in a lot of ways. I'm really curious, James, how would you rate this movie?
I'm giving Kubo and the Two Strings a 4.5 out of 5.
I'm wrestling with this because I've said this before on this podcast, and in retrospect, perhaps a little too forgiving. I've said that if it wasn't for the third act, this would be the perfect movie. And I think that's a bit of a hyperbolization. There's some small flaws, like the aforementioned humor. I think there's some humor in strange places in the first part of this movie. And then towards the latter half, they just kind of say, nope, we're hitting our stride. So there's that, but they're all very minor. However, I can't get past the third act, which we're definitely going to talk about in spoiler review.
Yeah.
It really bothered me at just how let down I was by some of the decisions they chose to make. And while they had a graceful start, they didn't stick the landing. I've seen worse endings out there. So I'm debating whether or not I should give this a higher rating because it's so well done and I want to praise movies like this, or a lower rating and say, listen, what the heck was up with that? But you know what? I'm in a forgiving mood today, and Kubo and the Two Strings has aged well, despite it being almost 10 years since I saw it for the first time.
10?
Yeah. No.
We were in college 10 years ago?
Sorry. Wait.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry, I forgot what year it was. I thought it was 2024 for some reason. I had a flash forward.
Whoa, this is weird.
Anyway, sorry, I'm back in the present day.
Okay, we're back.
This movie is 6 years old, and it's aged really well. And so I'm going to say 4.5 stars. Normally, I wouldn't give movies with terrible endings that high of a rating, but this is a movie that just does so much so well. And the ending is weak, but truthfully, it's not terrible. I can watch the ending and not cringe or be embarrassed about it.
Yeah. But
anyway, with all that being said, let's grab our swords and armor and head on over into the spoiler territory.
Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast to get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
Okay, real talk now. James, favorite moment in the movie?
I gotta highlight the action sequences. They're really great in this movie, and it's really impressive to see stop-motion action executed this way. They do similarly good action in The Missing Link, which is the movie that came out afterwards. And I would say that was the strongest thing that The Missing Link had going for it. Fortunately, Kubo had other things supporting it. But I'm going to say, I really like the fight sequence on the boat, the leaf boat in the middle of the long lake. That was really cool. And there was a lot of cool things story-wise being revealed as well regarding Monkey having the memories of the mother. And that just made it, it gave it some extra oomph, you know? What about you?
I am a sucker for really good villains, and this movie delivers. So for me, I think it's a... Gosh dang it.
Did I take yours?
No, there's just so many good moments. But I'm not going to cop out. The opening image is so strong. However, I really like Kubo's first encounter with the sisters at night. The sisters' design, again, they could have just had them dressed in cloaks and had them do weird magic, and it would have been fine. But then they went the extra mile and said, nope, we're modeling. We're going to take heavy inspiration from Guy Fawkes, and we're going to have them wear these masks with these frozen smiles, you can't see their eyes, and these long wide brim hats and these feathered capes. They just go the extra mile with it. And each sister has her own weapon. Like one has these chain sickles, and then another has two long daggers.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
I thought the second one with the daggers just had the pipe. I thought that was her only weapon.
No, her pipe is used to channel magic.
Okay.
Or not to channel magic, because they use magic without it. I don't know. The magic is very soft in this movie.
Yes.
As in it has no defined rules, but that's okay. I really... I'd say that, and then as a tie or a close second, I really, in a weird way, I really liked Kubo's interaction with the Moon King before they fight. He has this dream, and the Moon King appears to him as this kindly old man. And he doesn't take himself super seriously in a good way. He's just laughs at his own, yes, I'm blind, but I see twice as much, you know? And he shows Kubo where the last armor piece is. And it's a glimpse as to what the Moon King could have been in a more fully realized form. And I really like what Ray Fiennes brought to the table in that regard. I think I could feel through his voice acting, he just had such a great time with that character. So, yeah, those are my two favorites. I really just, there's a lot to like in this movie. But I love the villains.
Before you dip your toe too much further into the Moon King in the third act, I had an interesting thought while I was watching the action sequences with the sisters the other day. Especially whenever the mask breaks in one of the last action sequences at the Beetle hideout, whatever it's called. I think they used the same 3D model as the mother for these characters. And they just made three models of the mother and printed them out and put them in different clothes. And I think they wore masks to kind of save, you know, also add the mystery, but also it's a smart budgetary decision.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't get the facial movements of the villains, but whenever, and also to compensate for the billowy robes of raven feathers, they're floating. So you don't have to animate the walking. It's just a really mysterious and also economic character design choice and animation decision. But another thing about the mask breaking with the second sister, I bet they probably use the exact same face, you know, as the mother for that too. And you wouldn't know because it's been so long since we'd seen her, and you just see kind of the top lip down to her chin. Yeah.
I was thinking that too, actually.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clever. You got to be smart with this expensive medium.
Yeah. You got to be smart, but to your point, assuming you're correct, it's brilliant because they don't lean too heavily on it. They're not like, oh, whenever we're in combat, everyone's going to put on a mask and we're all going to fight in armor. You know, it's not like, okay, they're cutting budget, but they take some smart moves that just a year prior to this movie, Anomalisa also did really well.
Mm.
Really smart budgeting decisions that really help add to the story. And that's all I'm going to say on that, but if you want more clarity, please check out our review of Anomalisa. It's one of my more favorite discussions that James and I have had.
Yeah.
But yeah, the villainy, the aesthetic, this movie hits a lot of nails right on the head. And aside from that third act, it's a really good time. I have to say this, your first few minutes of your movie are the most important, or one of the most important, and the last few minutes. And these first few minutes, man, they just kind of set up this vague yet strong opening image. And then we cut to years later. We're not told it's years later, but there's all these subtle context clues that tell you that it's, you know, years later down the road. And it never really exposes to you what happened. It's not like, well, Kubo grew up and his mother started to lose her mind a few times and go catatonic. So he needed to figure out how to make her live and how to make a living himself. So he took her stories he told him and told them to the village people, which didn't know that these stories were in fact real. Nothing happens like that. You piece it all together in the first 15, 20 minutes. It plays almost like a short film.
Yeah.
The opening image flexes like, yeah, this is a big world. And then it immediately constricts itself down to saying, okay, nope, now it's going to be a very, very short. It's going to be like a short film about this young boy who lives alone with his mother in a rock cave. But by day, he's with the villagers. And even in the opening world, it still feels like an epic fantasy because of the certain rules they play. Like he can't come out after dark. He can't stay up after dark.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he ends up doing that is for a very emotional reason, a very personal reason. So, yeah, overall.
Plus, we get really fun magic pretty early on. Really interesting origami magic. Never really seen anything like it.
Right. And you'd probably know more than me, James. Are the origamis stop motion?
I have no idea. I don't know how they did that. There's so many places where I was like, okay, I know that big hill he goes down is actually physical and they made it.
Yeah.
I don't know about other shots. Obviously, the water they couldn't have done. The amount of things that they did that were actually physical will probably shock both of us if we actually did the research.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the origami, I was going to say, it felt like two different animation styles in one movie.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do naturally, but... Mm-hmm. This movie is a love letter to storytelling, and it's evident within the first act, and I love that. I loved it a lot.
Yeah, themes of, you know, all the stories that we know touch on something true, and themes of memories, and themes of our lives being stories, and, you know, what happens after life, and what happens to our story. You know, does it end? Does it go on? Where do we draw the line between the stories and the reality? All those things tie together in such a neat bundle. And I think That's probably one of my favorite bits in the third act that I didn't notice before, that touches on, that brings the theme of memories back to the forefront, which, yeah, I didn't appreciate until this time around.
Okay, I can't hold this in anymore.
I know you can't. Unleash the beast.
Okay, speaking of beast, when I say the third act is incredibly disappointing, I mean the bit with Kubo, like, realizing, okay, yeah, I know Mama's monkey, but then realizing, oh, and Beetle is dad, and we've been together this whole time. When the second sister ambushes them, and they win against her, but at great personal cost, they all die. That was when the movie stopped being good. And when it became just Kubo facing down against the Moon Knight, everything else after that...
Wait, Oscar Isaacs was there?
What?
Playing two different people?
They fly now?
No, you said the Moon Knight.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Does he show up in his skin-tight tuxedo and face mask?
And maybe.
Go, oh, I'm confused. Who am I?
It's not... That's James
Corden.
I'm going to
punch you with
that's
an Egyptian fist.
That's not Oscar Isaac.
I'm going to punch you with an Egyptian fist, mate.
Petition to have James Corden Kubo as a fat Asian man.
What?
Who's British. Oi, looks like I just did something in my trousers.
What? You said Moon Knight, okay? It was the Moon King.
Okay, I'm sorry. I couldn't follow you down that path because I've never bothered to watch Moon Knight. Okay, so the Moon King. The Moon King. When I say this ending is bad, I don't mean it's abysmal and terrible and it's one of the worst endings ever. That's not what I mean. What I mean is the level of craft and polish that this movie has exhibited throughout is not fully evident here. And the level of execution falls flat, in my opinion. The Moon King is built up as this shady, larger-than-life figure. We hear legends about him through Mother's stories. But then we get some interesting nuance that I really like throughout the earlier parts of the movie, where Kubo said, why does he hate me? And his mother says, he doesn't hate you. He just wants you to come and live up with him. Which is interesting because even after he's killed, his aunts, after his mother's died, his grandfather still wants him. And his grandfather doesn't position himself as this guy who's like, I'm evil. He's unlike the other villains because he comes across as very compassionate, but the way he goes about that compassion is flawed and evil and sinister. And his cold detachment from reality and the world that Kubo lives in is quite evident. So I love the idea of his character. What I don't love is when he fights Kubo, their fight becomes a large, big monster who rampages through things. And even though this whole movie is animated, it felt so CG. This big monster wrangling around, buildings are destroyed, comes up right in Kubo's face, and it feels more comical than it does grounded or dark. And he starts yelling at Kubo. He doesn't stop talking. He's like, you will suffer the same way as everyone else. And I was... and then I was going... All right, that's his mustache twirling moment. That's where it goes fully bad. Okay, all right. And I love the bullet points of the ending. I love that Kubo tries to use the armor, unbreakable, whatever, the sword something or other, and the helmet something. And he has all the armor, but what ends up truly defeating his grandfather isn't that, it's his memories. I like that. I just wish they could have gone about it in a better way.
Oh, me too.
And so, for one, I wouldn't have had him become a beast. I would have had him probably raise a beast or bring a beast down from the heavens, his home. There's even foreshadowing that's already in the movie, where one of the sisters, as she's fighting Monkey, mentions that she's fought against beings that could destroy the world in the palm of their hand, which is freaking awesome and gives me a lot of ideas about my own movies. But I love world building like that, just like offhanded comments like that. So yeah, there's already an in-world incentive. And then James, you mentioned the big skulls. a big monster in the movie is not unexpected, but what is unexpected is like, so you wish to fight. All right. And then he becomes a monster.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, listen, your granddaughters have sickles and daggers and they have combat training. I would expect that, or at least some type of powerful magic, you know, the same magic that Kubo's mother uses to cleave that tidal wave in half in the very beginning.
Yeah.
That could have been cool to have that level of power used against Kubo. And then Kubo to realize that the only reason he's still alive during this fight is because he has his armor, because otherwise he'd be royally screwed. But then realizing he's way outmatched and then resorting to the memories of his parents. Before I continue, James, I'm curious to know your thoughts.
I just wanted to add on and say I would have liked it if they'd had a classic samurai duel in the broken down town. Both wielding their swords. I feel like that's even a better instance at which the villain, if you need him to monologue more, he could monologue during a sword fight instead of as a big worm, which I personally believe is a Lycaflex and them saying, look at this big, cool, multi-layered creature that we made by hand and we're moving around. I think that was the one time Laika got a little bit too big for its britches and said, ooh, let's make a cool big monster at the wrong time. You know,
let's take the budget cuts we use for the sisters and make this big monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the only time where I have to tell you, Laika, less is more, you know, and you already know this. You did so much of Kubo so well.
Yeah. But
you're right. This is the only time where big monster. And for once, and if you've seen Sea Beast, this is a bit of a shock, but for once I went, no, I don't want a big monster. I just, it's all been leading up to this. I like the Moon King better as a human. Have him raise up a monster for Kubo to fight at least. Or
yeah, if you want to get your action in, you know, make him fight a big moon monster. That's fine. It could even be the big moon monster that you already made, like just let the Moon King, you know, watch from floating above or something. Monologuing.
I would have enjoyed more your idea of a samurai duel, because that's more personal. A duel, there's so much world building you do in action. The way a character fights with the sword, do they defend more? Do they attack more? I could see the Moon King, if Kubo was lashing at him with all these sword strokes, if the Moon King would constantly block and not really attack at first, that would give the impression that he's calculating something. There's a reason he's not going immediately on the offensive. He's biding his time. Like, all those little things add so much to the character. I can't read the character when it's a big wrangling worm destroying all the buildings.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of facial expressions big origami paper parade worm can make. Yeah. But the thing I wanted to emphasize that I mentioned earlier, I don't think the memories of the relatives and the ancestors destroying the Moon King or wiping his memories was really that great. I thought it was a really stupid, like, easy solution to this problem. Yeah. The thing that I did like, however, is whenever he did lose his memories, people told him who he was. And those memories made him into the person that he would become. And I feel like that drove the message home of, like, memories are so important because they make you who you are. And how you view those memories and how you forge those memories and how you mold those memories over time makes you the person that you are. And I thought that was a cool note. I wish there was another way they could have wiped the Moon King's memory. Secretly, I wish that the sword unbreakable and the armor crushable and the helmet of big-headedness would have actually been useless against the Moon King. I think that would have been really cool if at the end of the day, these tokens, you know, they gave Kubo some time to have a legit samurai duel with the Moon King for like 3 minutes, but then Sword Unbreakable breaks because he's a god.
Yeah. I would have loved the Moon King to just seem defeated and Kubo's like, you're done. It's over. And then he just kind of, the Moon King smirks and then like snaps his fingers and the armor just shatters.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he's like, well, yeah, it's impenetrable for mortals, you know, or something like that. The other thing that I don't like is actually Kubo. Kubo never backs down from the Moon King. He doesn't struggle with anything. he's just the entire time always full on, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. And I know that's been his character for most of the movie, but it would have been emotionally a more diverse texture to have Kubo for once realize, oh, I'm in way over my head. And as we alluded to with the armor, the sword, the memories, the mother and father, there's all these elements that are at play for a great climax. All the pieces are there.
Yeah.
They just don't play them very well. They don't play them as well as they have all the other parts of the story. And that's a disappointment. I actually disagree with you, James, on the climax where they wipe Moon King's memories. I felt it was really dark and weird that the Moon King should suffer the exact same fate pretty much as he did to Kubo's father. I felt like that was a little bit of a low move on Kubo's part. I think they could have done this in a better way by, if we must wipe the Moon King's memories, through some other means other than, let's summon the ghosts of my people and send them, use a force field. I would have liked, instead of the townspeople feeding this guy lies about who he is, I think it would have been fun for them to use truth. Like, he says, who am I? I don't remember. And then Kubo steps forward and says, you're my grandfather. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Kubo kind of alludes to that and he just says, hey, we didn't really get to know each other, but we were going to, and then you lost your memories. And then, you know, there's this desire the Moon King would then have of, oh, I'm sorry. Well, I want to rekindle that. I want to be a better person. I don't know, but maybe it's a little on the nose, but I think they could have done it better. But just the whole idea of, oh, Beetle lost his memories and was tortured and mind wiped by the Moon King, and now Kubo's doing the exact same thing. It rubs me the wrong way. It rubs me in a weird way. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I have no idea if that was Kubo's intention or not. It's just big magic blast that made him lose memories. So I'm just like, sure, okay.
He kept and marveled the memories out of the Moon King.
Yeah, yeah. It was literally just big magic blast. Captain Marvel came in and said, hey, kid, need a hand? And then just went... Let's try to end this on a high note, Daniel. One note I wanted to add about Kubo. The reason I want to go back and watch it again is because whenever we learn that this is not just a quest to find sacred relics, but it's actually a quest to reunite a family, it just makes all those interactions in the past hour and a half take on an entirely different light, because they're pulling at these strings, pun intended, of there's some underlying currents with these characters that barely know each other. You know, Beetle's flirting with Monkey. Kubo is being obstinate and obnoxious with Monkey. Monkey is being overly harsh and overbearing with Kubo. And whenever I saw it the first time in theaters, I was like, this is kind of weird. What is going on? Why is Matthew McConaughey flirting with a monkey? That's weird. He's like, oh,
biologically, it's confusing.
I'm like, stop. Don't do this to me. Why are they falling in love? And then I find out that they were married this whole time. And I'm like, that is actually really sweet.
Wholesome.
And
twist.
I love this so much. The most wholesome twist. Yes. That's something that you can't. It's so hard to replicate that in another movie, and this movie does it so, this unique thing in such a great way that's not creepy and weird. And I feel like it's hard to not make it creepy and weird often.
I think for me, on the last note I'll end on, is we haven't talked a lot about Leica Studios, but they're very interesting with their filmography. Paranorman, Coraline, The Missing Link,
Box Trolls,
Kubo, Box Trolls. Leica is like a master archer, and Pixar is like a seasoned archer with help from a lot of mentors. Because Leica, I get the sense, shoots arrows on their own, and they rarely hit the target, but they come really, really, really close to a bullseye with a lot of their movies. But they miss the target in some vitally important areas. But those areas change depending on the movie. With Pixar... before recently, Pixar would aim the arrow and almost get a bullseye, but before they were able to release the arrow, they had other people that said, no, a little to the right, okay, up, a little to the left. And all those other voices helped Pixar hit bullseyes a lot more frequently. Yeah. And when they missed the mark, it wasn't as obvious. It was very close to a bullseye. And so for that reason, why Kubo's significant to me is I feel this is the closest Laika's ever come to a bullseye.
Yeah. I think Kubo is a tie with me for a bullseye. It ties with Coraline. There is a plot contrivance in Coraline that is never going to allow me to give it a 5 out of 5, but it's also nearly amazing, nearly incredible. And I will still go back and watch that one again when it's spooky season. But I do agree, Kubo, I think, is flavored just for me. It's got swords, it got big monster, it got travel around, go place. All those little things that make my brain go buzz. But it really comes down to the characters and the showing and not telling that really is delightful for me. And that third act, it's a small stumbling block on this long marathon that is this film. And it goes so long for so well.
Yes. All right, guys. Well, we're Daniel and James, and you've been listening to our podcast, Casually Critical. And that really is the least of it.